Welcome to the Health Edge. I'm Mark Pettis, and really nice to be with you with my friend, colleague, John Bagnullo. John, it is very good to see you. It's been a while.
Hey, it's great to see you too, Mark. I'm, really happy to kind of kick off a few more of these. You know, we've both really enjoyed them. I think we both really, really missed these the past couple months. And so we'll be back better than ever, I hope.
Indeed, we will. And it's been a bit of a pandemic pause for both of us. And in Western Massachusetts, you know, we started to see our second wave in the fall. And it's really been a persistent focus and consumer of time and energy. And but now we seem to be on the other side as our numbers are starting to come down. We've been very actively rolling out our vaccination, and it's been a tremendous effort by a village of people, and that for me is gratifying. You know, just to be working with community agencies and human service agencies and public health folks. And so we're getting there, but it's been very hard to focus on anything but that. So it just feels so good, John, to be reconnecting and having some fun doing what we really love to do and are passionate about. You're in a word, John, you're a family. I'm sure a lot of folks who listen to the Health Edge are going to be wondering how you and your family have been doing. And
yeah, thanks a lot. We're doing well. I appreciate it. In the midst of a really traditional Vermont winter here with, really significant snowfall. And we've been blessed. We haven't had, any really extreme sub-zero stretches like we did a couple of years ago, but it's been good. We've been trying to get outdoors and ski as much as possible. And yeah, hey, it's great to see you though, Mark. It's been a few months since we've had a chance to dive into any papers or topics here, which I'm really excited to be back at it with you.
Well, our topic today seems perfect for a re-entry, John. And the concept of metabolic health, or as some might refer to, metabolic flexibility, metabolic resilience, I think are very cool and interesting concepts, John. And we both have been reviewing a paper that seemed a good review to base the topic of what it is to have metabolic health, what it is to be metabolically flexible, and just how powerfully metabolic flexibility predicts longevity and quality of life and disease risk reduction, perhaps more so than just about anything we discuss. And the evidence continues to mount there. At the same time, looking at this paper, this was a paper published in 2019, I think from one of your alma maters, John. This is from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Did you get your public health there, John?
I did. I got my MPH. Yeah, my MPH there.
Okay.
Yeah, 1995.
So this is from UNH, Chapel Hill. And this was published in a journal called Metabolic Syndrome and Related Disorders. And the topic of this paper, John, is the prevalence of optimal metabolic health in American adults. And the data that formed the basis of their investigation was from the National Health and Nutrition Exam Survey, the NHANES. And they captured the most recent cohort. NHANES is done it's every several years. They'll
every
update.
10, yeah.
Yeah, this NHANES database. So they looked at almost 9,000 people, and their criteria for metabolic health pretty much aligned, John, with the standards for what people review as metabolic syndrome. So it's having a waist circumference, if you're a man, of 40 inches or greater. If you're a woman, 35 inches or greater. It's having high blood pressure. And high blood pressure would be defined as a blood pressure greater than 120 over 80. It would be inclusive of triglycerides. And often, John, we refer to the triglyceride HDL ratio. So high triglycerides greater than 150, as defined by metabolic syndrome, a low.
And that's HDL. A really high. And that, yeah, that's a really high ceiling. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Mark, but just for our listeners' sake, 150 is a really high triglyceride to use as a cutoff. But
yeah, so we'll come back to that.
I'm sorry.
So these are the traditional standards, which you and I would both argue could be looked at in a much more rigorous way. So it's the high triglyceride, the low HDL, low meaning less than 40 or less in a male, 50 or less in a woman. So you've got the waist circumference, the blood pressure, high triglyceride, low HDL. And then the last is a fasting glucose of 100 or greater, which we would consider insulin resistant. And I know you'd have a lot of comments there as well, John, in terms of that alone. So these are criteria that are accepted internationally. But we'll make the case as we dive into this that as bad as this data is, it's probably still a bit conservative. But using those criteria, John, in the NHANES cohort of almost 9,000 people, only 12%, 12 out of 100 American adults were considered metabolically healthy by virtue of checking all those boxes. Waist circumference below a certain level, blood pressure at or below a certain level, triglycerides below 150, HDL above those factors, and a fasting glucose of less than 100, John. 12% of American adults met those criteria. So the take-home message, stunningly, is that the extent of metabolic health in American adults is alarmingly low. And this seems a good place to start, John, as we understand that all of these risks, insulin resistance and metabolic health in general, in addition to predicting cardiovascular disease, will predict cancer risk, Alzheimer's risk, virtually every chronic complex disease that we talk about is associated with these drivers. So what was your response to this, John?
That's a great overview, Mark. And it is really sobering to see those numbers. I don't think it's a surprise to you or I, because we look at, some of these reports in different areas, it may not be quite as comprehensive of this in terms of looking at lipids in conjunction with blood pressure and getting a sample size of 9,000. But that being said, look, there's a commonality here for, I'd say probably 95% of folks who have some kind of, metabolic syndrome, right? And it's insulin. I mean, that's the most common aspect to any metabolic syndrome or disorder. It's that insulin tends to be overproduced. It tends to be some type of desensitization within a person's body to insulin because it is being overproduced, meal after meal, day after day. And over time that catches up with folks and it alters everything. I mean, it alters, as you know better than anybody, alters renal function in so many ways. It obviously in there that trickles into blood pressure, and then it really challenges our liver in so many ways, and the liver starts to become burdened with the excess carbohydrate that can't be cleared, and it starts to be packaged differently. And so it's, look, that's where my money is. If I were going to try to really change one thing about a person's life in an effort to, improve their metabolic, make them more optimally, metabolic, it would be with insulin. And it seems that we dance around this, right? People keep talking about cholesterol and how can we lower cholesterol? You're not going to throw oat bran at the problem and have that solve it. It's interesting, right, Mark, how there's still this dichotomy to some extent where all these different conditions, right, like blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, the waist to hip ratio, everything's looked at and people throw things at it, but it's all about insulin, right? If you change someone's insulin on any given moment of time during the day and you can lower that, and chances are you're going to improve them in every every other aspect of this kind of big picture that you just gave us. And so I find it fascinating that we're at a point now where people still aren't speaking that language. I mean, if you want to really change someone's lipid profile and you want to get triglycerides down, and I would argue under 80 as opposed to 150, if you want to raise their HDL, if you want to make their A1C, you know, if you want to get that under 5.7, it's all about insulin. And yet we still hear about, as you know, like the types of fats you want to eat to lower your cholesterol and, you know, these different ways you can, you know, maybe lose weight and reduce the salt in your diet for blood. No, none of that is, none of that matters like getting the carbohydrate density of your diet down. And I'm not saying you got to be ketogenic to do this, but you got to really wrestle the qualities of the carbohydrates in your diet down. So I think that's, you know, in a nutshell, Mark, that's what I'd say is, like the single best explanation for why only 12% of Americans are, you know, in a place of optimal, you know, metabolic profile, so to speak. It's just people eat way too many carbohydrate dense foods. And it, look, if you're, if that's the feed bag that you're hitting every day, then, you know, this is to be expected.
That's such a huge distinction, John, and I agree. There appears to be an ongoing and rather dramatic disconnect with respect to the actual drivers of chronic complex disease and the extent to which the emphasis on the variables to control focus on very specific and less dramatic drivers like cholesterol or LDL. And In a follow-up article, John, and we can maybe get into this in a little more detail in a podcast in the near future, because I think it dovetails this study in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association Cardiology. And this was just published in January of this year. They looked at various markers, biomarkers that predicted cardiovascular disease. The title of this article is Association of Lipid, Inflammatory, and Metabolic Biomarkers with the Age of Onset of Coronary Artery Disease. And they focused on women. And again, John, what was interesting is they looked at various risk factors. And as it turned out, cholesterol and LDL were some of the lowest predictive biomarkers for cardiovascular disease in women. And often we talk about these hazard ratios, the likelihood of somebody with a particular risk getting the disease versus somebody without it. The higher the hazard ratio, the greater the magnitude of cause and effect as we think about it epidemiologically. So what did they find? They found that the single most powerful and robust was insulin resistance, high insulin levels or high fasting glucose. And as you and I talk about, John, hardly ever does anyone measure insulin levels. And we know that insulin levels will go up before a fasting sugar goes up. So you will pick up insulin resistance years before you pick up a fasting glucose of 100 or greater. But in this article, in this JAMA article, the hazard ratio of being insulin resistant was greater than 10. You just don't, you know, smoking and cancer or smoking and heart disease have a similar hazard ratio. Metabolic syndrome, the high triglyceride, the low HDL, had a hazard ratio of 6. As compared to, say, LDL, which had a hazard ratio of like 1.5, very weak predictor. High blood pressure had a hazard ratio of about 5. So these are powerful risk factors, all of which are modifiable. But the proposition changes considerably when you start focusing on insulin as compared to what you would focus on if your purpose in life was to lower total cholesterol and LDL. It's a very different roadmap, a very different lifestyle strategy. And so here's a paper in JAMA that is clearly showing much greater cause and effect, and it continues to de-emphasize the extent to which total cholesterol and LDL is what we should be spending most of our time focusing on. So insulin resistance, John, we know is a huge epidemic in the United States and around the world. And insulin resistance, we might clinically diagnose as pre-diabetes, a fasting blood sugar between 100 and 125, or a sugar after eating, you know, between 160 and 200. Anything in that range would be pre-diabetes. Anything above that would be diabetes. But as we always say, if you measured insulin, often you'd see very high levels. And anyone with a fasting insulin level above even 8 to 10, or an insulin level after eating greater than 20 is probably insulin resistant. And so the causes of insulin resistance, as you have begun to touch on, John, in large part are driven by the changes in the American diet, where these poor quality carbohydrate dense foods are, you know, on a good day, probably 55%, maybe 60% of what is consumed in the standard American diet. The diminution of healthier fat sources, which we know can very powerfully lower triglycerides and raise HDL, and certainly lower insulin as a strategy to allow one to reduce the carbohydrate macronutrient proportion, you start to see how the American diet has clearly driven many of these metabolic changes. And we see that as obesity has gone up, and 50% of Americans are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. You're looking at about a 10% prevalence of type 2 diabetes. It's probably a little bit higher after the pandemic. And pre-diabetes as high as 35%. And that's just looking at glucose. If you looked at insulin, those prevalence rates would be much, much higher. So this is perhaps, John, the biggest epidemic on the planet right now. And so what are some of the other drivers, John, from your perspective of insulin resistance? And what are some of the lifestyle strategies that you would be considering to help someone begin to modify these risk factors, these drivers?
Yeah, well, a couple things. One is, you know, there's a quantitative as well as a qualitative look at, let's just say, carbohydrates at first. And, you know, I think traditionally we've always approached the carbohydrate content of the diet more quantitatively, what percentage of calories or how many grams, et cetera. And that's still really a really common path that is taken. But I would argue that if you look at, you know, some of the papers that have been done over the last, let's just say, 20 years, and I really love some of the work that Mary Gannon and Frank Nuttall have done at the University of Minnesota with carbohydrate qualities and how that affects insulin and insulin resistance. You know, let's say someone, like, because your point is right on. I mean, on a good day, the average American on a good day might be eating 55 to 60% of calories from carbohydrate, right? On a day, let's say, when families are spending more time preparing meals at home and they're not eating on the go, or they're not eating processed foods, because then the numbers jump up to 75% of calories. And that's, you know, that's obviously not really biologically compatible with human physiology and our genetics. So, but then qualitatively, I would argue that, you know, it's probably just as important, if not more important, to look at the carbohydrate density of every carbohydrate that's consumed. And, you know, the sweet potato is a great example of this. There are areas of the world where populations eat this very significant percentage of their calories from things like sweet potatoes or yams and other tubers. And they might hit 55 or 60% of their calories from those things, at least during the season. And they don't really have any of this insulin resistance. And a lot of that has to do with the way a carbohydrate dense food, i.e. something made with flour or a grain, you know, based product, those might be 75, 80% carbohydrate by weight. whereas a sweet potato is 19 to 20% carbohydrate by weight. And the way those two things are metabolized is just so different, because we know the microbiome has a big say in insulin resistance. We know that, you know, really carbohydrate dense foods, if eaten on a regular basis, are going to really, they're going to lead to one level of dysbiosis or another. They're going to cause, you know, some bacterial overgrowth of the small intestine. And then once that happens, you start having these substances put into the bloodstream that actually ratchet up insulin production. It becomes a vicious cycle. And so I think that, again, I mentioned this just a few moments ago, and I know you feel the same way, Mark. We're not talking about a complete elimination of carbohydrates from the diet to solve this widespread pandemic that you and I are describing here with insulin resistance, and how that's leaving, you know, roughly 10% of the industrialized world's population in a place of good metabolic health. I mean, that it's not about a complete elimination of carbohydrates. It's about getting those down to, you know, whether it's 25 or maybe, you know, 20 to 30% of a person's overall caloric contributions coming from carbohydrates. But again, just as importantly, those carbohydrates should come from, you know, starchy root vegetables and, you know, modest amounts of lower fructose containing fruits, and very little in the way of, you know, grains and especially flour-based products. That's, you know, in my opinion, Mark, that's where the greatest return is from a behavior, you know, health behavior, economics type of model. You get people to eat less things made with grain and less flour-based products, you know, I think you make radical changes in this pandemic. You get more people to eat, you know, right, more protein-rich meals, you know, larger amounts of healthy fats. You know, you do those two things, displace some of the really cheap, in terms of this discussion, very offensive carbohydrates, then look, I mean, I think you produce widespread changes. But, you know, we're up against a certain amount of inertia here in terms of what's been produced, what people have been told to eat. So there, you know, there is some inertia that we're trying to overcome on both a marketing front, on a public health model, in terms of, again, you know, what people have been taught at every level, not just the consumer, but the clinician. And so, you know, hopefully we're changing that, you know, obviously not you or I, but hopefully research is changing that, as you're more aware than anybody, given your role, you know, in medicine. I'm just hopeful that people start to understand the importance of insulin and realize that there are some really, like, simple, straightforward ways to correct that. But it really all starts with looking at carbohydrates, both qualitatively and quantitatively, and making those less of a predominance in a person or a population's diet. The problem is, Mark, as you know, they're the cheapest, you know, your carbohydrates, especially your really cheap refined carbohydrates, obviously, they're the cheapest to produce, or the cheapest for people to purchase, especially if someone has limited income. You know, it's that's another part of the problem, is that these really carbohydrate dense foods, they're pennies compared to the higher quality protein based foods. So that's a layer to this that I think will require some, you know, I think that would be where government money is best spent in terms of trying to change this, is let's change the way we subsidize food, right? I mean, right now we're subsidizing the production of junk food and corn for God knows what, whether we say it's for ethanol, but most of it's for corn syrup and, you know, feedlot agriculture. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different ways we could approach this, but from the consumer's perspective, you know, the right carbohydrates, which is things that come out of the ground, like potatoes, sweet potatoes, carrots, parsnips, beets. I mean, these are going to not only give you the better quality of carbohydrates, but they're going to give you nutrients at the same time, unlike, you know, most of the real carbohydrate dense foods.
Yeah, that's great, John. And so many layers to this story in terms of the incentives and agricultural policy and marketing, and certainly the remarkable influence that industry has. And I believe it was back in the Nixon era, you know, all the way back to the 70s, where really the mandate was to produce cheaper foods for Americans and as an export. And we really did excel at that. And it seemed to become the basis for our monocommodity agricultural strategy and processing. And we really led the way in the ability to produce very inexpensive foods. And so this concept, John, of metabolic resilience or metabolic flexibility would imply that you're not insulin resistant. The body's ability to burn glucose as a fuel or fat, free fatty acids as a fuel could be interchangeable. And the body's metabolic ability to quickly adapt to the environment they're in and what they're consuming in those environments in a way that maintains insulin sensitivity is sort of how I think about metabolic flexibility. And anyone who's not metabolically flexible is going to have trouble losing weight, because until they get those insulin levels down, it's very hard to burn fat as an effective fuel. So when a carbohydrate moderated and a more liberal fat of better quality, of maintenance of good quality protein, we do know that the body's ability to learn how to burn both fat and glucose with equal efficiency becomes the metabolic byproduct of that. And that appears to be a very health promoting attribute. That is where people want to be from a metabolic perspective. Is that an accurate sort of reflection, John?
Yeah, Mark. No, that's awesome. That's an awesome description. And I love this concept of metabolic flexibility, because it's really, in essence, it's where exercise physiology comes together with endocrinology and really medicine in general. You know, it's we have those two major energy systems, and there's you know, the ATP PCR system for, you know, anywhere from 0 to 5 seconds of really, really high intense exercise, like a single max repetition, let's say, if you were talking about something in the weight room. But you got to be able to draw on both those systems, glycolysis. You got to be able to use, you know, you got to be able to use glucose either from glycogen or from your diet, you know, for at times, but you really have to be able to get into that state of beta oxidation, which you're describing, burning fat. And the faster you get into that state of burning fat, typically the healthier person you are. I've heard so many different takes on this, and I know you have as well. I mean, someone like Dale Bredesen, he may have said, I think it was Dale that said, you know, you could basically, you know, you could really quantify a person's all-cause mortality or risk for all-cause mortality by how much fat they burned over the course of their lifetime, you know, and it makes total sense, right? And it's a function of, like you said, it's a function of keeping insulin levels lower so that you can tap into fat, because it's not going to happen if your insulin levels are too high, you know, and it's also going to be a function of mitochondrial health, which, you know, you and I have talked about a lot. I mean, that's what's awesome about this. It's the mitochondria are front and center to this. You know, maybe just a backseat to insulin, I guess, if they are in second place. But I love this concept, and there's some people out there, and I'm not sure if you've read any of their work, but I've been a big fan of this guy Phil Maffetone for a long time. A lot of people have sought out Phil's work over the last 30 years, especially your elite long distance runners, cyclists, people that, you know, were really, really at the highest level of competition in their endurance sport. And then they started to crash. And you know, again, I think our listeners will find this interesting, even though it's kind of going in a direction of sports, sports nutrition, sports medicine. You know, you got a triathlete or a Tour de France cyclist or an ultra marathon runner who all of a sudden seems to just fall off the cliff in terms of performance and ability to even finish in the top 10, never mind win. You know, and what people like Phil Maffetone would quickly point out to them is that, look, you've been trying to run your body on carbohydrates, but you're an endurance athlete. And again, the analogy of this person to the average person that's just trying to be healthy, it might seem extreme, but they're not. They're actually, you know, an endurance athlete is just doing everything at a, you know, just a higher level or high intensity. But we all need to be able to burn fat as our predominant source of energy. And anytime we start to become over-reliant on carbohydrates, look, we got to retrain the body. And that's, you know, what you and I are talking about here. How can you cut your insulin levels in half? Because like you said, Mark, I mean, a fasting insulin of 8, it's not as good as a fasting insulin of 4, even though it might technically be considered normal, right? By our current parameters. It just because it's normal doesn't mean it's optimal. And way too many Americans have double digit insulin levels and that's just, you know, again, that's what we're talking about here. So, you know, it's all about how can you develop that flexibility? It's not about completely eliminating carbohydrates, and it might not even require that someone have to fast for 24 hours, but you have to do whatever tools you have available to you to try to drive that flexibility. And I think that's where exercise comes in, and not just endurance exercises or cardiovascular exercises, but also strength training, because, you know, building muscle mass, it's a great way to produce some of this resiliency or flexibility that you're describing, right? Create greater space for glucose uptake or utilization by, you know, what I consider to be a huge organ. That's our skeletal muscular mass, right? That's a big sponge for glucose. You soak up more of that glucose either at any given meal or, you know, what might be generated from glycogen, and then you're just going to be getting into a fat burning state faster. It's that simple. So yeah, that's a great description. And I love metabolic flexibility as a topic, Mark. I mean, this might be worth us revisiting at another time. But, you know, maybe we can put a paper or two there, you know, from a journal that I think I sent you a couple of these. One was from Cell Metabolism. Another one may have been from a Journal of Applied Physiology. But it's really important to bring everything you can to the patient's potential toolbox. And so I, you know, you're a huge advocate for intermittent fasting, as I am as well. It can really accelerate this change, right, that we're looking for in people, just like exercise can. And exercise is often misrepresented. A lot of people are told just to go out and walk and that's all you need. And I would say, yeah, like walking is a phenomenal form of exercise, and I'm all for it, but it doesn't mean that it should displace or rule out strength training, resistance training, whether you're doing push-ups, you're doing band work, something to stimulate your major muscle groups so that you can just, again, add one more thing to your arsenal as you try to wrestle your insulin levels down to, you know, an optimal place.
Great, John. And that, I think this will be a good foundation with our next podcast to elaborate a little bit more on the drivers of insulin resistance, and then to bring that back to some of these lifestyle interventions. I've always thought that resistance exercise tended to be emphasized, you know, cardio being what people tend to focus on. And, you know, as you suggest, I mean, obviously cardio is fantastic, but building lean body mass is really, I think, the holy grail. And there's more and more, certainly more research to suggest that muscle mass, something as simple as the power of one's hand grip, may be one of the best predictors of independent living later in life. It more and more data is speaking to the innate benefit of this metabolic flexibility and intermittent fasting and circadian rhythms. You know, we know this whole topic of circadian entrainment, which would be driven by meal timing and certainly sleep wake patterns and light. People with excessive blue light, particularly late in the day, tend to be more insulin resistant. It's fascinating to begin to consider the fact that a frequency of light in the 450 nanometer wavelength zone is one that might actually interfere with insulin signaling. And so we're learning so much more about how powerful these lifestyle interventions can be. And hopefully if our listeners take nothing away but this, it's that insulin really is a very worthy thing to be focusing on. Whether you measure it or not, anything you can do to lower the area under the curve of insulin that you are producing each day is likely to bring you amazing benefits in terms of quality of life, disease risk reduction, and people will see many metabolic biomarkers improving, like the ones we talked about today that are associated with metabolic syndrome. And as you get better at burning fat, you'll start to burn your own fat. We all have probably much more fuel that we're carrying in this reserve tank. And it's a tank that nobody ever accesses, you know. And so there's this fundamental paradox of eating like you need more energy than ever, while at the same time, you've got enough energy to probably live off for many weeks or longer that you're simply not able to access. It's like a bank account that you no longer have your the right PIN number for. And so until you bring insulin levels down, that those deposits are going to continue to stay in that account. And so all that we're talking about really is the runway to begin to be burning more of your own fat. And then, of course, that feeds into everything that we're talking about, lowering inflammation, lowering blood pressure, lowering fasting glucose and insulin, and lowering triglyceride levels, and lowering disease risk, and lowering depression, and the many other things that would come along with that. So this is such a great topic, John, because it really is sort of the foundation of so much of what I think is impacting health at many levels. And you just sort of casually dropped in, John, this observation that with respect to COVID-19, well, everyone is at risk, and we all know and have stories of people we know and love that have been impacted by this. Some have lost their lives by this. When you compare those who are metabolically unhealthy to those that are metabolically healthy, it's a different disease. It is a different pandemic. COVID will have very little traction in anyone with metabolic health. It will devastate anyone whose metabolic health is poor. And if this pandemic hasn't awakened others to that reality, then an important lesson is being missed, because this is a wake-up call in terms of the importance of knowing your metabolic risks. And once you understand them, doing all you can to fine-tune them, because whether it's your immune system during a pandemic, or whether it's your likelihood of requiring an Alzheimer's unit later in life, will very much be influenced by all that we are talking about. So good stuff.
Yeah, Mark, it was great. You know, the paper that you've described here initially, we've centered this conversation around. I think it was a great choice for this, because it leads you into so many different segments of lifestyle and medicine that, you know, that you can address as part of the story.
Definitely. Well, John, great to see you. With our next week, we can focus a little bit more on other drivers of insulin resistance. There's certainly more we can elaborate on there, and we'll bring that home. But great to see you as always, John. And you know, keep shining that light.
Hey, great seeing you too.
All right,
take care.
Peace.